Welcome to Worlds Apart. First, they came for the socialists in Cuba, and the world did not speak out because it did not feel the pain. Then they came for the mullahs in Iran, and the world didn't speak out either because the pain was too easy to ignore. And then they came for their adversaries in Russia, and the world took notice because the pain became all too palpable. Given the global ramifications of the Western sanctions against Russia, has the international community finally got enough stamina to stand up against the weaponization of global economy for geopolitical purposes? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Radhika Desai, professor at the Department of Political Studies and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba in Canada. It's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we are recording this interview at the sidelines of the Valdai Discussion Club, and this year there's a very vivid shortage of Western experts and academics for pretty understandable reasons. Many of them fear certain career consequences due to their participation or association with their Russian colleagues, even though, as far as I know, the participation in this forum does not oblige anyone to agree with the Kremlin's policies. Did you have any second or third thoughts about braving this journey from Canada to Moscow?
I do wonder whether, you know, I mean, we come here okay, and I do wonder whether when I go back, they'll say, what were you doing in Moscow? But beyond that, I don't expect anything. If they ask me, I will say I attended this conference, and there is no ban on attending conferences. I have been to this conference before.
Well, there is no formal ban, and yet, as we, those of us who follow Canadian politics lately, know that there could be some very informal consequences, pretty serious informal consequences for the academics.
Well, I think that informal consequences are precisely in the form that, you know, they withhold funding or whatever. You become unpopular. But I think that we are in a moment in history when I think you have to brave being unpopular, in the sense that what's the point of being popular in a world that may no longer exist? I mean, this is the key. So I feel that I personally felt it was very important to come to Russia at this point in history in order to talk to Russians, in order to understand what they feel. I mean, I certainly see quite a range of opinions here among Russians, among international scholars. And I think that unless we leave dialogue, lines of dialogue open, we are contributing to the tensions of the world. So I really feel that I'm here as somebody who is pushing against the contribution, because one of the ironies I feel that's in the West, particularly, including in Canada, is that everybody who's saying stand up for Ukraine is actually contributing and has contributed to the destruction of Ukraine, because it now appears increasingly unlikely that Ukraine can go back to the form it had before February 2022. And that's largely because this lobby has essentially advanced the West to the position where it is right now, where they refuse to implement the Minsk Accords, they refuse to listen to Russia's legitimate security concerns, and now look at where we are. So in the name, allegedly, of democracy and human rights, we're actually destroying life itself in Ukraine.
I want to discuss the issue of Ukraine in more detail, but before we go there, let's focus on sanctions, because this was the main topic of your speech at the Valdai Discussion Club. And you made a very interesting point that sanctions are essentially a form of colonial politics. And it was sort of intended as a means of warfare without spilling blood. Is it still apply this way? Because I think if we look at the indirect death toll of sanctions being applied against Iraq or Iran, you know, it's pretty easy to see how many lives they've taken.
The United States sees it as a way of conducting warfare without spilling blood. But what they mean is without spilling American blood. Mm. The fact of the matter is, and they know it very well, sanctions can be as bad, if not worse, than bullets and bombs. In fact, if you go back in the history of sanctions to the late 90s and early 2000s, it was the documentation of the harms inflicted by sanctions against Iraq, against children, innocent children, and of course adults and everybody, reducing the size of the Iraqi economy to a fraction of what it had been before. When these were documented, that was when the Americans had to shift, at least for public relations purposes, to the strategy of so-called smart sanctions. Of course, these sanctions are not smart. They're as dumb as any sanctions. And they are inflicting great harm, but they are at least not putting American lives at stake. Their other lives are completely dispensable. And of course, this, as you say, is a continuation, and I was arguing in my paper earlier, this is a continuation of essentially a colonial policy. But colonial policies were imposed by powerful colonizers against weak colonies. Whether the same can work by when you have an economy and a state as powerful as Russia is completely a different question. And as we have seen, practically every set of sanctions has boomeranged back on the West.
Mm-hmm. And not only on the West. I think I've spoken to many people at this forum, some of them from South Africa, others from Latin America, and they all are saying that even though they have no direct interest or no direct role in this conflict between Russia and the West, they are also being penalized.
Absolutely. The third world is being penalized in a variety of different ways, particularly in relation to food supply, in relation to energy prices and all sorts of other essentials. And as you said, they have no direct stake in this. They have not caused this conflict, like the Pakistan floods, you know, with climate change and so on. And I think that the vast majority of the people in the world will see the injustice of this. And quite frankly, it's going to make the United States even less popular than before. One really key marker has been that India, which has historically been at least in the last many decades, been a very pro-US power, is staying out of this. It's not supporting the West. It is not condemning Russia. And I think that's important as a key weather vane. You know, if even India is not doing it, I think it shows that the world is not happy with the United States.
Now, many experts, including Western experts, noted that the United States failed to properly assess the effects of those sanctions on third countries, which I think allows the United States a certain benefit of ignorance. As somebody who studied that issue academically, do you believe that's an unfortunate failure of foresight, or is it actually a deliberate decision to simply ignore and to believe that, you know, they can take it? If we decided, they can take it.
Well, I think that the way I argued in my paper is that the issue of why the United States keeps imposing sanctions, even though it is very clear that they're not effective in having the effect the United States want them to have. Cuba has not become capitalist. Venezuela is still standing. North Korea is still standing. These sanctions, on the whole, they do not succeed. What they do is kill a lot of people, but they do not have the effect that the United States wants them to have, which is change the behavior. Change the behavior of the regime or change the regime. This has not happened in most of the overwhelming majority of cases. You know, they say it is madness if you keep on repeating the same action and expecting a different result. This is what the United States is doing. And I think that after 40 years of neoliberalism, 40 years of and 30 years of unilateral power projection, etc., the United States and many Western countries are in a spiral of irrationality. And I basically call what the U.S. is, you know, the U.S. position vis-a-vis sanctions is a kind of mania. They keep repeating the same actions. And I think they're doing this because they want to show that they still rule the world. But in fact, especially against Russia, every sanction they have imposed has underlined how much they don't rule the world.
I started our conversation with a reference to this post-World War II poem by the German Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller, who, like, first they came, and it was essentially about the silence of German intellectuals and the clergy at the rise of Nazi ideology, and then the very targeted purging of their opponents. And for the record, I'm not making a direct comparison, but what strikes me is that those malfunctions, structural malfunctions, are apparent to everyone, and yet very few people not even brave enough, but sane enough to talk about that. And the things are only getting worse. Why do you think, with all this lip service to freedom of speech, critical thinking, rationality, what have you, why do you think there are so little people who are ready to voice their skepticism or their doubt, even for their own sake? Because I assume they want their country, the United States, to prosper.
Well, I'm reminded of two things in response to this. There is, in addition to Pastor Naimola's little poem, there is also the whole, there's also that quote, you know, those that the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. And I think that's what's happening to the United States collectively. The second thing it makes me think is that, you remember you earlier asked me, why aren't there more Americans here, etc., and, you know, what are they afraid of? I think the same thing that makes Americans afraid to come here is what is blocking their ability to see just how sick their system actually is. Because they're not coming here because they're still looking for those little pieces of, you know, little treats they will get if they don't come, if they appear to conform. But the fact is that they are actually, these things are nothing compared to the dangers they are reinforcing by not questioning the consensus in their society. And I think, of course, I have to say, many Americans are standing up. Many Americans are demonstrating. Many Americans are part of organizations that are spreading the real information rather than the disinformation. But they are obviously a small minority.
I don't know if you agree with me, but I think for better or worse, very inconsiderate or ill-considered move by the United States to introduce very, very broad sanctions against Russia and penalize the rest of the world as a consequence. It produced a certain very strong resentment among the third countries. And you can hear them both at the Valdai Forum. I sense it in many of my interviews. Do you think that's enough for producing any practical change, when the countries of the world will say that, you know, the global economy belongs to all of us and it's ultimately not to one country to decide how we are supposed to live and who are we supposed to deal with?
Well, I think if you look at what's happening, you know, when the United States demanded that everybody should impose sanctions on Russia, everybody should support Ukraine, etc., a small number of countries, essentially the old imperialist core of the world economy, plus a few added hangers-on like the Eastern European, some Eastern European countries, I should say. But beyond that, basically the vast majority of the peoples of the world and the people of the world have refuse to support the United States. What we are increasing, and I should also add, by the way, that the Europeans, whose governments are currently cooperating, seem to be bent on economic suicide. As everybody can see, their economies are being destroyed as a result of complying with US demands. So even this so-called alliance, this idea that somehow suddenly President Biden has found a way of uniting the West, this is not true. It is creating new cracks in the European Union. It is creating new cracks in the alliances that, you know, that pro-American alliances, and it is creating cracks within European societies. It's going to sharpen political contradictions in them. So that's a second thing. So basically what we are increasingly looking at is, okay, Europe is uncertainly still clinging to the United States, but increasingly the rest of the world is going to look elsewhere for the economic relationships and the economic models that they wish to have. And that will be more towards China, Russia, and other such countries. And I feel that we are now looking at a new bipolar world. But, you know, in the old bipolar world, you had two sets of societies that were all reasonably prosperous and reasonably stable. This new bipolarity is more dangerous because, on the one hand, you have the Western pole, which is increasingly, possessed not only of collective madness, but the material basis of that is economic decline, and along with it, social division, political division, cultural degeneration, etc. And on the other hand, you have a set of societies that have the possibility and, in many cases, the reality of greater stability, a greater prosperity. So I would say that the weaker side and the madder side is going to potentially create a lot of problems. So that is the key danger in the world. That's why we are entering this dangerous world.
Well, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will discuss that particular danger in a few moments. Stay tuned.
Thank you. counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Radhika Desai, professor at the Department of Political Studies and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba. Professor Desai, before the break, we were talking about the potential dangers that the world is facing right now. And I was recently reading through the letters that Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy exchanged during the Cuban Missile Crisis, because we are marking the 60th anniversary of it this month. And I was struck by this sense of shared responsibility. Both leaders expressed the desire for negotiations and called on each other to demonstrate some sort of state wisdom. I think that was a direct quote from Khrushchev. Do you see that same sentiment of shared duty, not only before your own people, but also before the rest of the world, expressed these days?
Absolutely not. And this is obvious at so many levels. So first of all, let's say in terms of, and by the way, I would say that it's the West that does not display the same sense of responsibility. So first of all, they are fighting all these wars in the name of democracy and human rights. But in fact, what they are doing is extremely unpopular, which is why President Biden is going to lose the midterm elections, or his Democrats are going to lose the midterm elections.
Well, unless they use some tricks up their sleeve.
Well, maybe, but we'll have to see. And in which case, I think the other side is not going to sit quietly aside. So we will have another civil war-like situation in the United States. Then at the international level, the sense of responsibility is absolutely absent in at least two or three different ways. Number one, Russia is being demonized in a way, and not Mr. Putin. Russians are being demonized, and this is something really scary. You are demonizing a nation of nearly 150 million people as a group. Like, what kind of a thing is that? I thought we left that behind with the demonization, the Nazi demonization of Jews, etc. So that's the first thing, and that's really scary. The second thing is that the Biden administration is basically out to, they don't want to talk to Russians and Russia on the whole. I mean, I know many channels are open, but on the key points, the channels are not open.
They openly express that it's below them. I mean, there is a sense of superiority, moral
superiority when it comes to Ukraine. And that is something that our world cannot afford. So that's the second danger, because, you know, remember, the Cold War was a heavily managed affair, in which the two sides always had communication with one another. This is not so anymore, and this is why it's very dangerous. And finally, I'd like to say that there are so many problems in the world, primarily climate change, but many others that need international cooperation. We need international agreements to solve climate change or international terrorism or whatever problem that's your favorite problem. You cannot have it without international cooperation, and we've just undermined any basis of that.
Now, Professor Desai, I also have to say that the military campaign that Russia is waging in Ukraine is also very unpopular in Russia, because nobody likes sending their sons to the battlefield, and nobody likes being extremely worried for their relatives across the border. Many of us have families in Ukraine, but the biggest question, I think, for the Russian political establishment is whether they had any other choice of stopping a very arrogant, and some would say very ignorant hegemon who ignored all the previous efforts of solving this issue diplomatically. I'm not asking you to take Russia's side, but I'm sort of trying to rely on your academic expertise and geopolitical expertise to see what means were there at Russia's disposal to put an end to this constant pushing by the United States.
Well, I think like in the... So first of all, my position is that no matter what you think of Russia, and I have to say in my case, I do try to follow the war and its conduct as much as possible. And my understanding is that there are not that many choices for Russia. Between fall of 2021 and early 2022, Russians did everything possible to try to achieve a negotiated settlement to their concerns. But this was not given to them by the West. So having said that, I would say that the Russians are kind of doing what they're doing. And to me, the most important thing is that should NATO, which is basically the force that is at war, and the United States, which is the other major force that is at war with Russia through Ukraine, should they win this war, it would be a disaster for the world. So it seems to me that once again, like in the Second World War, the Russians are going to pay a disproportionate price for world peace. And it's very unfortunate, and I totally sympathize with everybody who has relatives on the front, who is worried about their children going to the front. I think, obviously, this is terrible, but I think that if NATO wins this war, which it is fighting extremely irresponsibly, including, well, there are two things that I should say here, irresponsibly, but with the support of fascists in Ukraine, and in a way that is actually destroying Ukraine while claiming to stand for Ukraine. I find that, you know, we are living in an Orwellian world where everything is its opposite. What people are saying and what is really happening, what our authorities are saying and what's really happening could not be further apart.
But even in the Orwellian world, you don't have claims of a potential use of nuclear bombs. And this is something that is very much on in the focus of the Russian officials lately. They've reached out to the American, British, Turkish, French colleagues, fearing that there could be some provocation involving a staged explosion of a dirty bomb. And they were essentially dismissed without any interest in the technicalities of the intelligence that they had to, they could provide. What does it tell you about both the stage of this conflict and the stakes involved? Because one could, you know, the argument I hear from the Russian side is that radiation knows no borders. So if there is an incident, it will affect all of us. And it would be a major escalation. It would be extremely difficult to sort of put that genie back into the bottle. Why do you think there's so little sort of self-preservation instinct in the West, at least in Europe?
Well, I mean, I've thought about this a lot. I've listened to various sides before the present Russian attempt to try to get Western powers to pay attention to the possibility of this dirty bomb. There were a couple of other things. Remember, the Western countries were saying, oh, Russia is going to use tactical nuclear weapons in the battlefield. And before that, there was this whole issue of who was bombing the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. So I think we have a lot of really irresponsible actors at play on the other side, on the Western side, on the Ukrainian side. Number two, I would say that it's important to remember that historically the United States is not only the only country to have used nuclear weapons without any reason to do so. It's not true that they needed to be used to stop Japan. There was absolutely no, and American scholars have shown this. So they are the only country in the world to have used nuclear weapons. They have driven the nuclear arms race. They have been offensive. They have never accepted no first use. And they have also been known to have used radioactive weapons in wars. So they are the ones, I feel, that they have been creating. First of all, they have been spreading stories about potential Russian use, spreading stories about potential Russian attacks on nuclear power plants. These are false stories, in order that they may prepare the ground for essentially launching a false flag operation.
You mentioned that the United States was the only country that used nuclear weapons before, but it also has a very painful experience of supporting certain proxy forces and then being attacked by those very proxy forces. And the other day, Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman compared Vladimir Zelensky to Bin Laden, saying that he's actually even more dangerous because he has the power of the state at his hands. And he also has access to pretty dangerous technology. What are the chances, do you think? And again, it's hard to say, but based on your knowledge of history, do you think there's any chance that the Ukrainian leadership, after not getting what they want from the West, will turn against it in the same manner that Osama bin Laden?
Gosh, I actually haven't listened to that Zakharova interview myself, but I have personally made a similar analogy. You see, what happened in Ukraine over the last many months is that not only do they have neo-Nazis supporting the government going back to 2014, but now most of the opposition is gone, so they are basically reliant on these extremely, you know, essentially neo-Nazi forces. In addition to that, they have issued a call for other people who think like the Azov Battalion to come and fight with them. I'm not sure how successful it's been, but whatever success it's had, now you have an international brigade of essentially fascist forces who are fighting on the side of Ukraine. This is not unlike the creation of Al-Qaeda and Mujahideen and so on. So on the model is the same. You essentially attract people on the basis of a really reactionary ideology. And, you know, in the kind of sick world in which we live, there are always some people in every society who will be attracted to these ideologies. And so they are encouraging the worst aspects of our society. And I suppose, I mean, you know, this is a frightening thought. If it is, if, as I believe is quite likely, Ukraine is, Mr. Zelensky is not going to get what he claims he is going to get, which is, you know, the restoration of the old Ukraine, including Crimea. I mean, this is completely nuts. And in fact, everybody who is for peace should be telling him that this is not going to be possible. But anyway, if he does not get, I have no idea what will happen. And certainly this is among the possibilities of what could happen, because who's going to control this force if the state authority collapses, or even if it doesn't collapse, if the state authority tries to use it against other forces?
I think within the Russian culture, including governing culture, there is a certain respect for the enemies and an understanding that you need to accommodate your enemies' interests for your own sake, to preserve peace medium or long term. And what puzzles me is why something like that is lacking on the American, or for that reason, the Ukrainian side. Because like Russia, whatever you think of it, is a huge country with an enormous military potential. We talked about rationality. You have to be able to make those analyses.
I mean, it goes back to what I said earlier, because American blood is not being spilled. Russia is spilling its own blood in order to, you know, essentially achieve its, what I think are fairly limited military objectives. I don't think Russia is out to take all of Kiev, unless, of course, something changes and it is forced to, you know, all of Ukraine, unless something changes and it is forced to do so. But I don't think that was the aim at the start. But the Russians, they are, and as far as I know, by the way, the conduct of the war is, broadly speaking, you know, many of the so-called retreats, for example, have been undertaken in order to ensure that there is no excessive loss of life. On the opposite side, however, you have the mirror image. You have essentially an army which is into putting on a show of going to war. So there is a lot of smoke and mirrors on their part. And they seem to also have an army leadership that wants to defend undefendable positions, even if it sacrifices a lot of lives.
Well, so they're trying to give the Americans what the Americans want, which is the, you know, winning television image.
Exactly. So that, you know, in the West, this completely, shall we say, completely nuts type of strategic behavior on the part of those who are governing the Ukrainian army is portrayed as bravery. This is ludicrous. Armies don't need this sort of bravery. What armies need is cool, collected decision-making about where it is reasonable and where it is advantageous to fight and where it is advantageous to withdraw from. Because you're not in this to, you know, win some kind of theatrical victory. You're in this to win a real victory.
Well, Professor Desai, we have to leave it there, but let's hope that the world will still be in place for the next year while they're meeting. Hopefully, we'll talk some other time.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.
We'll be right back.